From VOA, the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. According to NASA's Orbital Debris Program Office, there are more than 25,000 objects larger than 10 centimeters in the space surrounding Earth. They estimate that there are 500,000 pieces of space junk between 1 and 10 centimeters in diameter, and the number of particles larger than 1 millimeter is more than 100 million. Think about it. Humankind has sent thousands of rockets into space since the launch of the first satellite, Sputnik 1, in 1957. While many space vehicles are still in active circulation around our planet, others have since dropped from orbit and were destroyed by the burning friction of re-entering Earth's atmosphere. Some of that falling debris fell to Earth in chunks. To make matters worse, over the years, satellites have exploded, collided, or simply just disintegrated, leaving a thick trail of fragments. Some pieces of space junk are as small as a fleck of paint. But despite its tiny size, a fleck of paint flying at an average impact speed of 10 kilometers per second could still severely damage an active spacecraft, or even worse, an astronaut performing extravehicular activity, also known as a spacewalk. The International Space Station and its human inhabitants are subjected to the threats of fast-moving space debris. NASA says the U.S. Space Surveillance Network frequently checks on the path of space debris to detect possible close encounters. If another object is expected to come within a few kilometers of the International Space Station, the ISS will typically perform a maneuver that moves it away from the incoming object if there is more than a 1 in 10,000 chance of a collision. Fortunately, the agency says the space junk avoidance maneuver is rarely used, about once a year on average. Today we'll discuss the growing problem of space junk, which is also called space or orbital debris. My guest for today's show is John Krasidis, Ph.D. He's the SUNY Distinguished Professor in the Department of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering and the Director of the Center for Multi-Source Information Fusion and the Center for Space Cyber Strategy and Cybersecurity at the University at Buffalo. John, what is space junk and where does it come from?
So it's defined as anything that's not useful anymore. So it could be a piece of space debris, could be easily something that could be a satellite that's not functioning, a rocket body that's up in space, or as simple as a paint flake, or even like a little micrometeorite.
And how many pieces of space debris surround Earth? Any estimate? And what are their sizes?
We currently track about 30,000 objects that are about a softball size or bigger. It's about 10 centimeters. And we really don't know how much there is below that, but it's estimated that between 1 to 10 centimeters, there could be about 600,000 objects. Below 1 centimeter, it could be millions upon objects in that sense. And that's a big problem because we can't track them and they're traveling very fast at 17,500 miles per hour.
John, can you give us a little overview of the dangers of space junk?
Sure. So as I mentioned, they're traveling very fast. And the issue is they have to go that fast to actually orbit. And anything slower than that is going to cause the Earth's gravity to pull them back in. So if you look back at the days of Newton, as people think about the apple and gravity, it wasn't that problem that he looked at. It was actually this problem. Imagine a cannon on top of a very high mountain, and he shot a cannonball. And it hit the ground. And he shot a little faster, hit the ground a little further. And he asked himself an interesting question. At what velocity do I have to fire this cannonball so it never hits the ground? And that's 17,500 miles per hour. Anything slower than that, the Earth's gravity is going to pull it back in. And that's exactly how he discovered gravity. So we have to get him up that fast to actually go in space. So when you see astronauts floating in space, you shouldn't think of them as floating. They're actually falling at 17,500 miles per hour, but never hitting the ground. It's kind of a different way to think about it. So what the danger is, I like to use a car lane analogy. If you have two cars next to each other at 17,500 miles per hour, that's fine, meaning that they're in the same orbit. But there's different kinds of orbits. For example, you have satellites that are going around the equator and some satellites that are going around the poles. In that case, you're looking at a T-bone intersection case where it could be a violent collision, right? So if you're driving a car 17,500 miles per hour and another one that's going perpendicular to you, that could be a very violent collision. A very small little piece of marble, for example, can wipe out a satellite.
What would you consider to be the first piece of space junk?
There's some early space junk. I probably would think Ed White's glove. There was a spare, when he did his first spacewalk, a spare thermal glove had floated away and came back in. So that's an interesting piece of space debris. There's some other ones that are interesting too. A lost spatula. I don't know if people were cooking in space, but a lost spatula from the space shuttle. In the old days of the space shuttle, they used to dump the urine over and it crystallized. Mm-hmm. That was considered space debris. In 2011, you can see a curlicue feature in the sky, and that was actually the urine that was reflecting back. So even urine was considered space debris.
Where are most space debris located and how far from Earth's surface?
So most of it is in low Earth orbit, which is considered to be 200, 300 miles up and anywhere between that and about 500 to 700 miles up. And then then it's pretty clear until we get to about 22,000 miles up. That's called the geo belt. And that's where a lot of our communication satellites are. The reason why they're there is they have the same period as the Earth. So we go around every 24 hours. Those satellites go around every 24 hours too. What that means is from our vantage point, they're looking like they're standing still in the sky. So that's why you can point your antenna dish at that constant location. So in between there is our GPS satellites. They're pretty safe because there's nothing really in between it. So it's pretty much that low Earth orbit and what's called the geo orbit at 22,000 miles up.
And speaking of space junk distribution, is most space junk evenly distributed in space or does it basically envelop the entire Earth?
It basically envelops the entire Earth.
How is space junk being detected?
So we currently have a sensor network. We have sensors on the ground. There are a lot of data gaps, especially in the Asia area. And we have a few telescopes in space too. So basically two ways. There are telescopes. Obviously, you have to wait till night to see those. And radars. Radars can only really see the low Earth orbiting object. They don't have enough power to see those up there in geo. So we rely on telescopes. And this is one of the problems too. We just don't have enough sensors to track these objects all the time. And we lose them. And we have to use models to predict where they're going to go. And unfortunately, those models aren't as accurate as we want. And that's how we end up losing things. For example, there was an object, I think in 2002, that was discovered by an amateur astronomer. They actually gave it a name and later found out that it was at an upper stage of Apollo. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly how they identified it, but it was lost for many, many years, obviously. It wasn't until 2002.
Can you tell us a bit about the U.S. Space Surveillance Network and its work in keeping track of space junk?
Right. So we currently track about 30,000 objects, and it's an interesting way of taking the difference between what we track and what's actually in the catalog. To get into the catalog, you have to actually identify that object all the way back to a launch. So that'll identify basically what country, quote unquote, owns that object. So that's far less. It's about 3,000 or 4,000 objects that we don't exactly know where they are. And so, yeah, they go and they track these objects with the telescopes and the radars. And once they get the hit on them, they still don't know exactly where they are. So the way I like to say is, I'm sitting in a classroom and I talk to the students about this. I say, okay, everybody estimate my height within a centimeter. So not everybody's going to give me the same answer, right? That is essentially noise. My height is 5'8". And some people will be kind and say I'm 6 foot. Others won't be so kind and say I'm 5 foot. But there's a spread there. And all sensors have errors associated with it. So even when we get a hit on these objects from a sensor, we still don't know exactly where they are. The bigger problem is when we don't see them, and like I said, we have to use models to predict where they're going to go. And that's where things can get really hairy in terms of trying to determine where they are and keeping track of them.
I understand there are close to 5,000 satellites operating currently, with more and more being set up each year, and probably a good number of those that are no longer operating. What is normally done with a satellite or related space gear once it's taken out of operation?
Sure. So we have some guidelines, and the Europeans and Canadians and a few other countries are following them. Any satellite that has thrust remaining, we are going to deorbit it over the Pacific Ocean at a specific location where there's really nothing around. And the reason why we do that is just in case something gets through, which very small chance of that happening anyways, it'll burn up in the atmosphere. But unfortunately, not every country is following this. For example, Russia and China are not following these guidelines. And then anything that does not have thrust, we have to show using simulations that drag. So in this low Earth orbit regime, there's still air molecules up there, but it's not enough to breathe, obviously. But it's enough to cause the same drag you'll feel driving in a car and put your hand out the window. And that drag is going to cause that satellite to come down. We have to show that that satellite is going to come down within 25 years. Now in GEO, up really high, those satellites are going to stay up there forever. And what they do is put them in graveyard orbits, which is a couple hundred kilometers away. And hopefully they're not going to come back in. But we've shown some models in our simulations that show that they may come back in close to that GEO belt within 50 years. So probably should go out a little bit further than just a few hundred kilometers.
John, what is the Kessler syndrome?
So yeah, Donald Kessler, back in 1978, he had this prediction where you have satellites that are colliding and causing debris, and that debris is going to collide with other satellites or other pieces of debris. We end up with this effect where you're going to just cause a lot more debris just because of these collisions. And we really don't know the number of collisions because, again, we can't track the smaller objects. And what he said is, we're going to get to a point, if we don't do something, where the chance of colliding with a piece of space debris is going to be so great, it's just not going to be worth putting any satellites up there. So you got to think, when you put a satellite up, it's just like car insurance. You have to buy insurance for that satellite. These insurers are not going to insure these satellites. Now, common question I get asked is, are we at Kessler's point? No, we're not close right now, but we're getting close to a tipping point that if we don't do anything within the next few decades, certainly within 50 years, we are going to be, I think, at Kessler syndrome, where low Earth orbit is going to be essentially useless.
Let's take a break. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm your host, Rick Pantaleo. I'd like to remind you that Press Conference USA is available for free download at voanews.com/PCUSA. You can also find our show on Apple Podcasts and other podcast websites. We hope you'll connect with us on Facebook at VOA Current Affairs or Facebook and Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA. You can also just send us an email to PCUSA@voanews.com. Let's get back to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Today, we're discussing the growing problem of space junk, which is also called space or orbital debris. My guest for today's show is John Krasidis, Ph.D. He's the SUNY Distinguished Professor in the Department of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering and the Director of the Center for Multisource Information Fusion and Center for Space Cyber Strategy and Cybersecurity at the University at Buffalo. John, back in January, an astronomer reported that he found a piece of junk that had been floating around in space for a couple of years that would be crashing into the moon on or around March 4th. There was also some discussion on the origin of the space junk. On March 4th, there were news reports that a huge piece of space hardware did indeed slam into the moon, with scientists calling it the first time a piece of space debris unintentionally crashed into the moon. Can you tell us about this piece of space debris, how it was first spotted, its trajectory traced for a lunar impact, the controversy surrounding its origin, and what actually did happen at 12:45 UTC on March 4th?
Well, Bill Gray was an amateur astronomer and a software developer. He first noticed this and did some analysis to try to determine exactly what it was. And as many people know, initially thought it was a Falcon 9 rocket body. And then came back and did some more analysis and said, no, it's really the Chinese Chang'e 5 rocket body. So the way a lot of people are trying to figure out exactly, well, which one was it? The analysis, from my understanding, is because of the paint. And you can tell the difference between our paint and the Chinese paint. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I'm not a paint expert, but that's what they're saying, and I believe them. The impact, yeah, happened about 5,800 miles per hour, and we really don't know yet because it hit the far side of the moon, actually hit a crater the size of Iowa, and we're waiting probably in about a week or so when a lunar reconnaissance orbiter is going to be around the area and hopefully can find and see what happened exactly.
Since the rocket part did smash into the far side of the moon, as you said, telescopes here on Earth were unable to observe the crash and its aftermath. And as you mentioned, NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter wasn't in position at the time to observe it either. So how did scientists know it actually crashed?
Oh, you do an orbital analysis. You can get very accurate information to tell when things are going to crash into things. This is kind of common things when things from far away are coming close to the Earth, and we do analyses by telescopes, and it's basically a lot of equations and a lot of math to get us there. But we have a very good feeling. Obviously, they nailed it pretty well. They said the date. And so that's the stuff we've been doing since the days of Gauss, when he was 23 years old and found a lost asteroid and predicted when it would come back. So been doing this for hundreds of years without a problem.
Now, do scientists have any idea the extent of damage to the moon from the impact?
No, I mean, there's not. This caused probably about 60-foot crater. This is nothing in the grand scheme of things, but it's going to be exciting, at least from my understanding, for the planetary scientists to actually get some real data on a fresh crater. So that, from that point of view, it's interesting, but from the point of view of harming the moon, no, nothing at all.
What responsibility do you think companies and even governments that put satellites and other spacecraft have in ensuring that their used gear be disposed of properly?
Right. I think everybody should follow some simple guidelines. Back in 2010, the United Nations put out guidelines, and it was really good that it got on United Nations radar screen. The problem is, not every country is following this. So that would be a good starting point. So example, guideline 4 says, do not create more space junk. Seems like a simple thing, right? Mm-hmm. But as we know, a few months ago, the Russians blew up one of their own satellites, which caused about 1,500 pieces of debris. The Chinese did this back in 2007. India did this too, but that caused much smaller pieces of debris. It was much more controlled, about 70 pieces of debris. But even the simple stuff of don't create more space junk, you think that would be an easy one to do, and not every country is following that. So we got some serious problems. We can't even follow the very simple one.
Space agencies in a couple of countries have been experimenting with satellite intercepts. And back in November, Russia did conduct a direct ascent anti-satellite test, destroying one of its own space objects. How have efforts such as those are affecting the space debris environment?
So that one caused an issue right away. The astronauts and cosmonauts had to take shelter in the space station because one of the pieces of space debris from that collision was getting close to the space station. So they put their own cosmonauts into harm's way. So just think about that for a second. But we don't know the long-term impact yet because it's just a recent event. But we do know a lot about the Chinese incident that happened in 2007. That was in January. And 6 months later, NASA's Terra satellite had to do a maneuver because there was a 7% chance that it would be colliding with one of these pieces of space debris. So yeah, it's already causing problems. And that Chinese stuff, it's predicted that 30% of it's still going to be up there in the year 2035. So we're going to have to contend with this for quite a while.
We've been hearing more and more about the problem of space debris lately. How long have scientists recognized it as a real issue?
I don't think people took it seriously until 2009, when two big satellites, Iridium was one of our communication satellites, and Cosmos was a defunct weather satellite from Russia. So what we do is we track these. As I said, we use models, and we do a probability of collision. And if it meets a certain threshold, which is 1 in 10,000, right? It doesn't seem like it's very big at all, but anything bigger than a 1 in 10,000 probability chance, we are going to do a maneuver. Those two satellites did not meet that threshold. But just like the lottery, it's all based on probability. And like I said, we don't know exactly where this stuff is. Those two satellites, quote unquote, won the bad lottery that day, and they collided and caused about 500 pieces of space debris. That sent up a big message to us that says, well, wait a minute, we're not tracking this stuff as well as we thought we are. And this possibility of two big satellites colliding, I mean, just imagine those colliding to the look in to say, well, how about now these smaller objects that I can't see? So I think 2009 is when people started really saying, we got a problem here.
The picture you paint with the amount of space debris orbiting Earth reminds me kind of a shooting gallery. What are the odds of a satellite in orbit or other spacecraft in orbit of getting hit by space debris?
It's still very small. I think this is part of the problem, right? Because there haven't been too many events. The astronauts had to go in 2011 into the escape hatches too, because there was a piece of space debris that was coming close. The space station has done over 20 maneuvers in the last 20 years. That's actually a lot. But there really hasn't been anything really catastrophic in any sense. So that's why I don't think people are taking it as serious as they should. What I like to say is, you know, space station didn't start until 1957. That's not that long ago. And look where we are right now, where we're talking about this. We've had some events. And if we don't do something, imagine where we're going to be 50 years from now. That's why I say I think Kessler syndrome is going to come true in 50 years from now.
Have there been any real initiatives developed in ridding space of human-made debris? And are there plans being developed now to do so? And if so, could you share some of the ideas being considered?
Sure. There's no shortage of ideas. There's a lot of researchers looking at this. NASA's obviously looking at this. A lot of them have to do with trying to grab debris by some way, like using a net or grabbing it using some robotic arm. But then the question is, what do you do with it? Harpoon is an interesting one. I don't particularly like that one. But if you look up the remove debris mission, they did two experiments where they had a net that grabbed a piece of space debris that they put out. And they also did a harpoon. The harpoon I don't like because if it doesn't go through the object, it may ricochet and cause that object to go into a different orbit. So anything that requires you to get to a piece of space debris sounds like it's a good idea and sounds like something easy to do. I live in Buffalo, New York. I can drive my car to Washington, D.C., get some gas, you know, drive it down to Carolina, and then drive it down to Florida. Unfortunately, you cannot do this in space. My colleagues from Texas A&M, Dr. John Junkins, Dr. Terry Alford, I think said it best. You're fighting Newton and Kepler. You're going to lose every time. And this involves some heavy-duty mathematics, but you can't go from point A to point B very easily in space. So for example, if you just want to do a 10-degree change in your orbit, that's going to require about 40% of your fuel. So maybe we'll get to point A, pick up some space debris, maybe get to point B. I doubt you'll be able to get to point C with current technology. So that's the problem we have right now. There's a lot of these ideas that require you to get to that debris. You're going to build a multi-million dollar satellite to take out a few pieces of debris. It's just not cost worthy at this point. There's other ideas like shooting lasers at very small objects, but you know, shooting lasers in the sky is something that we don't want to do. There's other things that we do to protect our satellites. For example, Fred Whipple actually in 1947 invented what's called the Whipple shield. And essentially a small little piece of debris will go through the shield and it'll shock it. It'll still hit the wall, but not go through it. The space station has over 100 Whipple shields. So there's lots of ideas. Unfortunately, we don't have anything that's at the point where it's really technologically feasible. And like many things, we're just going to have to pass this off onto our kids.
Do companies and government space agencies consider space debris when they're preparing to launch a satellite or other vehicle into space?
So for us, you have to talk to the FCC to get a specific location. We're launching our satellite that we're building here at the university, and we did get our slot. So yeah, they're going to try to put in it. They're not going to try. They're going to give you a slot that they know that there isn't one of those 30,000 pieces of object that we track to make sure it's not close. And then, yeah, hopefully you'll be okay. But like I said, we do our thing. We work with some other countries. Got to think right now, there's over 100 countries that have launched objects into space, right? So, and there's more coming in the next few years. So, and there's not really a lot of coordination with all these countries. And that's part of the problem we're having.
You're at the University of Buffalo, and I understand the university was recently chosen to lead the Space University Research Initiative Project. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. It's actually two parts. It's to look at space debris issues, too, but also look at what's going on at the moon. We're starting to send objects at the moon, and there's some interesting things going on there that are a little bit more defense-related, but there's some interesting orbits out there, very mathematical in nature, I can't describe, but James Webb Telescope is in one of these orbits. And when I think about, well, okay, we're causing this problem right now in Earth. Do we want to go to the moon next and cause this problem with the moon? So again, we have to think 50 years ahead. So a lot of things that we're looking at are how do you better track these objects? What sensors do you need to put out there to get what's called persistent surveillance, to be able to track objects 24 hours a day, how to optimally place those sensors so you don't want to put too many up there because that's going to cost you money, right? That's just throwing a lot of money at the problem, but you obviously don't have that. And various other aspects related to space domain awareness and trying to solve some of the initial research problems. Like I said, we just don't have the technology right now. So we're looking to say, okay, what technology do we have right now? And also, what new thing can we develop that hopefully we will be able to transition in the next few decades to be able to solve some of these problems.
How do aerospace companies and space agencies, especially those launching manned spacecraft, protect their spacecraft against threats of collision with space junk?
They're not protected that well, actually. So that's a problem. I don't want to be pessimistic about it because really the chances of a human being hurt in space right now are very, very small, but it's non-zero. That's definitely true. One question I get asked is, what is it going to take for us to really take this problem seriously? Unfortunately, like everything, I think it's going to take a very catastrophic event, like a human being hurt or possibly killed, before we really take this seriously. But for now, it's not a big concern, to be honest with you. It's still very safe to go up in space. I'm looking forward to going up someday myself, and I'm not going to be worried about space debris, to be honest with you.
There's an old saying that what goes up must come down. How much space junk actually falls back to Earth?
Well, we really, really don't know in terms of the objects that we don't track. That's part of the problem, big part, actually. Again, with the stuff that we do track, we know when it's going to come down. So it'll come down eventually in low Earth orbit. It just may take several decades. The stuff in GEO, the 22,000 miles away, and that stuff is never coming down. That's going to be up there forever unless we do something about that. So think about that orbit. It's a very interesting orbit because of its characteristics that we can essentially, it look like they're standing still with respect to us. But if we keep putting satellites up there and then putting these graveyard orbits and eventually start coming in, 100 years from now, that could be a big problem too. So we have to stop thinking in just 5-10 years from now. We have to think of 50-100 years from now.
A number of nations have put satellites and other vehicles into space. So the issue of space junk has really become an international issue. Are there any treaties or agreements in place regarding space debris? Any plans to do so?
No, there are none, actually. That is a very big problem. As I said, the United Nations put out some guidelines, but that's all they are, is guidelines. And like I said, not every country is following them. I don't know why we don't have international treaties at this point. That's way above my pay grade, but I think that should be a no-brainer. And again, why can't we do this simple stuff? I really don't know. It's really confounding me.
You kind of alluded to this earlier, John, but I do understand that the Earth's atmosphere can help with the problem of space junk. How so?
Right. So there's still air density up there. We don't know the exact nature of it, but we know it well enough that, for example, since the early days of the space age, to be able to bring humans back in, right? We know approximately where they're going to come down. So we got it modeled well enough like that, but we don't have it modeled well enough to understand fully where it's going to come in uncontrolled. So for example, you heard about the Chinese rocket that was coming back in. We didn't exactly know where it's going to come in because it was coming in uncontrolled. So yeah, it's, again, just think about putting your hand out the window. You can feel that air resistance. And that air resistance still is affecting those satellites. It's just a much smaller effect up in space, but they're still there, the air molecules. In the 22,000 mile orbit where the GEO satellites are, we don't have any of that going on, but we got something else called solar radiation pressure. If you want to think of it as solar wind, that's fine. It's really not solar wind. It does push those satellites around as well too. We have to do these things called station keeping maneuvers. And these are maneuvers just to keep it in their slots to make sure that they're not going to drift away out of their pre-designed slot.
John, I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today and bringing us up to date on space junk.
Thank you.
That was John Crisides, PhD. He is the SUNY Distinguished Professor in the Department of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering and the Director of the Center for Multi-Source Information Fusion and Center for Space Cyber Strategy and Cybersecurity at the University at Buffalo. And that's all the time we have for this science edition of Press Conference USA. I hope you enjoyed today's show. Thanks so much for listening. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.